Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. After years of exploration and research in Utah's remote Nine Mile Canyon, often called the world's longest art gallery, Verlicia Perez wrote a new book titled Echoes of the Ancestors. This guidebook invites readers to discover the canyon's rock art panels, ancient granaries, and forgotten ruins with fresh eyes. Echoes of the Ancestors is designed to be much more than a traditional guide. It's a way for modern explorers to connect with people who lived in the canyon centuries ago. It highlights Nine Mile Canyon's cultural significance while encouraging stewardship of its fragile sites. So we welcome in for the hour, Verlicia Perez. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I appreciate the chance to join you today.
We appreciate it as well. So I understand you are a corporate trainer and a fly fishing guide. I guess the two, you know, a life is complicated, but those are two highlights.
Yeah. So I've worked for a company for about 4 years doing corporate training. On the weekends, I'm a fly fishing guide. And prior to working corporate, I was a wilderness instructor. So kind of go back and forth and have the best of both worlds by working corporate and still being able to be paid being outdoors.
Why'd you come out of the wilderness? The corporate trainer pays better?
Well, obviously that is part of it. But to be honest with you, the company that I work for was a pretty primitive company, meaning we weren't supplied tents. We lived in tarps, made like A-frame tarps. No backpacks. We had to make those out of juniper tree and paracord. And I'm a little older. I'm 53. So it started being a little bit hard on my body. And I thought, okay, maybe it's time to hang up my hiking boots for full-time work. And it just, it happened that I landed with a company that I absolutely love right now. So everything worked out well.
Yeah. So it sounds like that company was primitive. You describe it. I guess they wanted people to have kind of a real wilderness experience?
Correct. It was working with disadvantaged youth, and it's one of these things where when you pull conveniences away from people, they really can and do realize that necessities are all you really need in life. And it just kind of got them down to bare bones and kind of rebuilt who they were and how strong they were and what they thought was important versus what is really important. So, yeah, I recommend Wilderness to everybody. I think it's a fantastic program.
Yeah. Born and raised in Utah or elsewhere?
I'm actually from Southern California.
Ah, okay.
But I've been out of there for about 25 years or so.
So you're drawn, obviously, to the outdoors, to wilderness, et cetera, et cetera. What drew you to Nine Mile Canyon?
Yeah, so my connection to Nine Mile grew from this deep passion for history and storytelling and remote landscapes. I am a member of the Tohono O'odham Nation, so I've always felt a strong pull towards Indigenous cultural sites. And from the beginning, I knew Nine Mile was a place filled with rock art, but being there in person was something else entirely. This canyon has a presence, like this quiet power that sinks in the longer you stay. And you realize these walls hold stories of lives once lived. So I suppose my early curiosity quickly deepened into something more. And I started asking myself the bigger questions, like who created these and what were they saying and who carries their voices now?
Now, of course, there are other places with rock art. This is a spectacular example, the world's longest art gallery. Why do we think this particular canyon, has so much rock art and it's preserved to the extent that it is?
Yeah, so I have been fortunate enough to have many conversations with archaeologists the last year while I've been researching for my book. And one of it is just sheer location. You've got full-time water supply through Nine Mile Creek. So that is one of the biggest things. It's pretty good landscape for farming. In fact, there's still ranchers that still work full-time in the canyon. I'll tell you some stories about the Mead family that I've met down there. But it's all about location. It was a great location for the Fremont, who are the biggest components within Nine Mile Canyon. They were farmers, And so it was a great area for them to be able to landscape and to hunt and to plant, and it was just very sustainable.
So, for people who don't know, where is Nine Mile Canyon?
Sure. So Nine Mile Canyon is right outside of Bryce, Utah. I'd say it's in between like Salt Lake City and the Green River. So you're looking about maybe 2.5 hours west of Salt Lake.
I want to loop back to some of the technical aspects here, but I'm trying to find this quote, the science of interpreting rock art. It's a little later in your book, but I want to treat this right now, because you talked about this wonder, right? And this feeling that obviously these were people who lived lives and were curious about that, right?
Sure.
But in the book, you talk about how scientists, I guess, trying to interpret this rock art these days are more humble than they used to be. Tell me about that.
Yeah, sure. So I really do feel like part of the mystery behind it is we're never going to know what it means, right? Like, there's descendants that can give us oral histories that are passed down through generations, stories that offer a deeper, more human understanding of the canyon more than any textbook can, but we're never really going to know. And one of the problems that I really had an issue with doing research about the book and seeing other guidebooks out there, it was this reality that much of what's been written about this area, especially in the past, has really reflected a predominantly Euro-American interpretation of the landscape and its history. And there's a long history of cultural insensitivity when it comes to interpreting Indigenous art. And I didn't want to add to that harm. So I approached this project not as an expert, but as a student. I listened, I read, I researched, and I really tried to hold space for the stories we may never fully understand. And it just felt that too often speculation was presented as fact, blending archaeology with assumptions, and that just didn't sit right with me. So that's kind of when I began my journey.
So I could see there are some positives to that, aren't there? The mystery we probably will never solve, although we want to.
Sure. Yeah, so, oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so well, it's just having those conversations. I think that's the biggest part of the book is, yes, they are mysterious. Yes, it looks like decoration, but I really hope that my book sparks curiosity with people to help better understand what they're looking at with curiosity and reverence, and not just being dismissive, as I've seen it being quoted as ancient doodles, right?
That's pretty dismissive, isn't it? What's the you talked about sense of wonder. What's it like in Nine Mile Canyon? A lot of traffic or no, or can you be places in that canyon where you're pretty much alone?
Yes, so that is the beauty and the incredible thing about Nine Mile Canyon. Number one, no, you're not going to have a lot of traffic. In the last year, Tom, I have been in that canyon 39 times. And a lot of it, I saw maybe one or two cars the whole day there. So it is absolutely incredible. And the sheer amount and variety of rock art is, it just really, that whole, world's longest art gallery, when you're out there, you can see why it really lives up to that name. And it's incredible. You're seeing culture expressions like stories of survival and identity and belief left behind by people who lived in this region over thousands of years.
Is this BLM land? What is it?
Yeah, so it is BLM land, some of it. Other is private property. And then we have Utah State Land Trust. So in the book, I do specify, hey, you can hike in this area, or this is private property. You can view rock art with binoculars from the street, but please don't impose on the ranch, land. It's never hurtful to have some kind of, like, I use onyx just to verify exactly where you are, just to make sure that we aren't trespassing on private property.
You mentioned in the book that you hope people will not just kind of go to GPS coordinates that you provide, that they'll retain the sense of wonder.
Yes. Yeah. So my goal wasn't just to create just a field guide. I wanted to encourage a more informed and respectful kind of engagement with the canyon. So I want it to be looked at with curiosity and with reverence. Like this place spans an incredible timeline. So what I really hope readers take from the book is just a deeper awareness, not just of the rock art itself, but of the cultural and historical context that exists within it. These sites aren't just decorative, they're expressions of identity. So yeah, I really do hope that it just becomes part of a ongoing cultural narrative of being curious about it, asking the questions about it, and it really does become part of a broader dialogue about how we view the past and honor its significance today.
You know, I bring that up because there are some folks who kind of just go collecting, right? Collecting experiences. Mm-hmm. They'll go to a remote place, take a photograph, take a selfie, and that's the purpose, right? Obviously, that's sure. not what you want people to do in Nine Mile Canyon.
Sure. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, if that's what you choose to do is go in there, as long as you're being respectful and visiting with reverence, you know, I don't have a problem with that. That's okay. But I do hope that you are curious. I hope that you don't just bring a camera, but you bring, you know, curiosity and you bring questions and you want to have a deeper understanding of what you're looking at.
Let's talk, I want to get into some of the art itself, but early in the book, you talk about some, you know, just practical matters. You have a rating system for the terrain. Tell me a little bit about that. Some of it's pretty easy and some of it's going to be pretty hard to get to.
Yeah, for sure. So it really does, the cool thing about this canyon is it's kind of a pick your own adventure. And what I mean by that is, all of the rock art, or 99% of the rock art, can be seen from the road with a good pair of binoculars. But how involved do you want to be? Do you want to get up to it to look at it closely? Yeah, it's going to take a little bit of work to get up there. So I did a 1 through 5 difficulty hiking system, just so people know what they might be getting themselves into. And you're right, it could be a matter of opening your door and looking at a panel that is like roadside, right? You could open your door, take 2 steps, and you are at the face of the panel. Other ones, you might have to scramble up about 300 feet of shale and be careful of where you're standing and walking and placing your hands, because the rattlesnakes are out now. I saw 2 last weekend. So yeah, it can go anywhere between 1 super easy to 5. You better bring your A game and be ready for a little bit of a hike.
And there's some places you probably can't go. It's private land.
Correct. And those are in my book. I simply said it's private property and you need to view those from your binoculars, which is okay, right? Like there's places that we don't necessarily want a bunch of people at. I was very deliberate even in my book about certain locations that to me are either too fragile or too sacred to be promoted in a public guide. I know where they're at, but it's something that I deliberately left out of my book, for sure.
Yeah, I wondered about that. I'm glad you brought that up because, I've talked to other people who've written books of this kind that aren't going to reveal those places, right? It's just too dangerous for people for numbers of people to go there.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, you know, one of those, like, how do you approach sharing the significance of Nine Mile Canyon while also protecting its sites from harm due to increased visitation, right? Like, that's a really important question that I've been asked and one that I've spent a ton of time wrestling with even before I began writing the book. The truth is, yes, anytime you put a spotlight on a fragile place, you have to consider the impact that attention might bring. And I didn't take that lightly for a second. From the onset, my intention wasn't merely to guide people to these sites, but to foster a deeper respect for them. And I knew if I was going to publish a guidebook, it couldn't just be about directions. It had to be about education, about ethics, about context, right?
So you say you approached this book as a student. What kinds of people did you talk to?
I've had the absolute joy of speaking to a few archaeology professors. I have interviewed about a dozen Indigenous elders to get their perspective as well. I have talked to some of the ranchers. I'm going to give you a short story. Ben Mead, who is the owner of 9 Mile Ranch, has lived in the canyon his entire life. He's in his late 80s. And he was just a wealth of information about the settlement history, right? Because we have to remember, it wasn't just the indigenous, but we did have the settlers that came in after them as well. So I've been able to gain a really broad perspective of everyone that has inhabited the canyon. And it's just been a wonderful experience to get everyone's stories. Everyone has a story, right? So it's been really cool to hear everyone talk about this place.
I think you use some modern technology. You talked in the introduction about some of the difficulties you faced, including dead camera batteries and dead drone batteries. Did you use a drone?
I did. So some of these locations, like for the guidebook, I wanted to make sure that I had pictures of what you should be seeing. When you're talking about petroglyphs or pictographs, it's hard to describe a 3-inch rock art piece that's on a 1,000-foot cliff wall. How do you find that? Where do you see it? So I made sure that I took pictures so when the reader is at a certain site, they know what they should be looking for. And some of those places are inaccessible, at least for me. So I would throw my drone up, take a picture of it, and bring it back down. I felt like that was the most or less invasive way that I could get a photo instead of, climbing up on some fragile rock pieces. Just threw the drone up, got some pictures, and brought it back down. So, but yeah, I mean, drone batteries die, camera batteries die. When you're out in 9 Mile Canyon, you have zero cell service. It is a very remote, rugged location. So if I had technical difficulties and I needed to, I don't know, download programs because something bad happened or I couldn't pull a program up for my drone or whatever the case may be, it was a, 45-mile drive back out to get service to reconnect something to come back into the canyon. So, yeah, I did have some technical difficulties when I was out there. It was always a funny thing. It's like, man, is everything going to work out today? And if not, I'm going to have a long drive out and back in.
Are there any dangerous areas?
I would say it really does depend on what you choose to do. Sure, it's super rugged. And there are rattlesnakes and there are all kinds of wildlife out there. And if you're not careful, animals go into defensive mode. It's not intentional, it's not malicious, but they're just protecting themselves, right? So you do have to have a little bit more spatial awareness about what is going on. We were talking a little bit earlier about, climbing up some rocks, and that's great, but where is your hand being placed? Can you see where you're placing your hand to make sure there's not a beautiful rattlesnake there sitting on the rock sunbathing? So yeah, there are some dangers. You just have to be very aware of where you're at. It gets really hot in the desert. It's over 100 degrees during the day, during the summer, so I would suggest no midday hikes. Go in the morning, go in the evening, and kind of relax when it's the heat of the day. Heat stroke is very real out there. And again, no cell service. You do not have emergency services at your beck and call out there. So you do have to be very careful about the kind of adventure that you are willing to have. Risk versus reward.
Let's take a brief break. We're talking with Verlice Perez. She's written a new book. It's called Echoes of the Ancestors. It's a guidebook to the what's called the world's longest art gallery, 9 Mile Canyon, which is out somewhat near Price. And we'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Verlise Perez. She's written a new book called Echoes of the Ancestors. It's about Nine Mile Canyon. It's been called the world's longest art gallery. Reading from the book, Nine Mile Canyon boasts over 1,000 pictograph and petroglyph panels, features more than 10,000 individual images documented by archaeologists. With no written records, these images serve as the primary window into the lives, beliefs, and environments of those who lived here long before written history. There's where I want to start, Valencia Perez, in this segment. How long ago did these peoples put up this rock art?
Yeah, so some of the oldest images come from the Archaic period, which is over 4,000 years ago. These ones are typically more abstract. You might see spirals or dots, zigzags, and they may seem simple, but they carry a lot of meaning. Many are thought to represent maybe spiritual or celestial concepts, and they remind us that people were connected to this landscape long before, you know, farming or permanent dwellings ever existed. And then as you kind of move forward in time, you begin to see the work of the Fremont, who lived in the canyon around 15 to 700 years ago. Their rock art is incredibly distinctive. You've got trapezoidal human figures. They're often seen with elaborate jewelry or headdresses, bighorn sheep, hunters, ceremonial scenes, that kind of thing. And the cool thing about the Fremont is they just didn't leave behind rock art like the Archaic did, but they also built granaries right into the cliffs, some of which are still standing today that I kind of point you to within the book as well. You can see excavated pit houses and defensive posts, stacked rocks where they would hide behind up on a cliff face in a canyon to be able to look up and down the canyon to see who was coming in. So it's really amazing to see how they adapted and thrived in the canyon. And then later on, you see the marks of the Utes, whose descendants are still part of this land today. Their rock art dates back from about the 1600s to the 1800s. And this is where you see a really dramatic change of that time, because now we have figures on horsebacks where the Fremont did not have that. We've got rifles, we've got buffalo hunts. It's really powerful to see these images layered alongside earlier ones, because it really does show that continuance, but also the change.
How did these subsequent peoples seem to treat the art of the previous peoples? Was there any art over the top of previous art, or was that respected?
Yeah, no, they're definitely, it's kind of like, okay, we know you were here, but now we're here kind of sense. So yes, you do see some layered on top of older or painted directly next to, I'm talking the pictographs, right? Images painted in red or orange pigments rather than carved. So yeah, there are some that are overlaid, and it just seems to be this sense of we're here now.
Mm-hmm. Pictograph, petroglyph, what's the difference?
Sure. So a petroglyph is something that is chipped in or pecked in, abraded into the rock, where a pictograph is something that is painted rather than carved. They're much rarer in the canyon. They're usually found in protective alcoves or overhangs. So when you find one, it's really special because they aren't as common as the pictographs in the canyon at all.
How do these ancient artists make this work?
So they used a variety of different hand tools. It was usually a bigger rock chipping into smaller rock. And then with the pictograph, they might use something like ochre or manganese or different minerals that they would find within the canyon to be able to make a paint. And it's crazy how this stuff survives over thousands and thousands of years. There is a pictograph panel. The location is in Sheep Canyon. I'll go into the side canyons in just a second, but it is an absolutely spectacular panel. It is done in red ochre. and it's in a very light sandstone. So the red ochre really pops. And this thing, they age about 1300 to 1800 years old. And because it's in this protective alcove, the pigment is just absolutely stunning still. It is probably one of the prettiest pictographs that I have ever seen.
Tell me about the range of this art. What kinds of images do you see?
Ooh, it depends. It depends. If you are looking at just archaic, like I said, you're going to see something very simple: spirals, dots, zigzags, lines. But the Fremont probably have the biggest presence within a 9 Mile Canyon. There is a location that I did not put in the book. Number one, it's on private property. I was given permission by the rancher to go up and look. But the entire butte, it's a hike up. The entire butte is covered in nothing but war scenes, fighting scenes, mysterious shield-bearing figures. So we imagined that there was quite a bit of a battle over terrain and location up there. So you'll see a lot of that. Lots of animals, what are called quadrupeds, anything with four legs. And then we also have things like birds. There's one panel in particular that you can see what look to be like either two sandhill cranes or some kind of big bird that are facing each other. And that's another cool thing about the rock art out there is direction actually matters. Like, are all the animals facing in one direction? That usually is significant for a migration pattern. Are two human figures facing each other? That would usually mean something like conflict, facing each other in battle. So it's really cool to think about what you're looking at, not just as rock art, but as a way that they are trying to tell us a story about what has occurred or what had occurred during that time period.
I want to get into that. What was the intent behind this? Some of this we probably can't decipher. One thing that I think is pretty universal is that this art was meant to last, at least outlast the artist, maybe outlast even the civilization.
Yeah, for sure. That's one thing that I really want people to understand is this was not meant to be decorative for us, right? These are living records of cultures that are still there. And it's incredible to kind of look to see what it is like. Just they're so detailed, some of them. Some of them you absolutely cannot decipher whatsoever. There's one in particular that has been named the Juggler. And this figure is an anthropomorphic upper body with a headdress, meaning there's horns coming out of the head, but the bottom of it look like octopus tentacles coming out. And then the arms look like they are juggling balls, right? It's a fantastic, fantastic petroglyph, but one that you look at and say, what in the world could that mean? Some of them are very obvious. Some of them really just let your mind, honestly, just start to wonder about what in the world could this possibly have been. And the beautiful thing is, no matter how much we try to interpret, we're never going to know. We are never, never going to know. And maybe it wasn't meant to be understood. Maybe it was just meant for the time and the people that did it in the moment. And it's just going to be a mystery for us.
Are the obviously, we were here, right? That's one universal message. Do we? I'm sure we have some theories, right, as to some of the, what some of these things mean. What are some of the functions, do we think, of some of this art?
Yeah, sure. So some of them are spiritual, right? It could be like they think that some of the ones in the higher areas, the super high cliffs, I'm talking 200, 300 feet up, that are hidden, like in an alcove. That might be a rite of passage, only meant for specific people that they knew would be passing through that. Maybe a coming of age, young man or woman. Other ones, they have linked up that some of the dots could be calendars. We had a little bit of a thing going on just this past weekend where every time we came across a series of dots, we would count them. And we probably did that at 25 different sites. And all but one, Tom, were even numbers. So that is a curiosity, right? Was it a calendar? Was it some kind of weight counting system, maybe for planting, maybe for harvesting? Like, we just don't know. A lot of them coincide with equinox or solstice, archaeologists have found. Take something as simplistic as a ascending or descending spiral, ascension. That could be something significant like birth or moving forward, where the descension could be something like retrospect or death. So yeah, look at these things with curiosity and don't take them for face value of this meaning anything, just or not. Let me back up. Looking at it and just taking it for face value of, oh, it's just a spiral. No, there's a deeper meaning behind these. Be curious, try to figure out what it is. Read other books, not necessarily just mine. Read other books about rock art and different interpretations or meanings that archaeologists have come up with while working with indigenous culture, to try to figure out what these things mean.
You were there in all seasons. Is there a different feeling in different seasons?
Yeah, so I was there in every season. I was there in the winter, post-holing through snow, and there in the heat of summer. And the winter there, it's, the canyon's always quiet. But winter there is a whole other feeling. It is incredibly quiet. I think some of the most meaningful times I had in the canyon were in that quiet. Maybe in the spring, sitting alone under a cottonwood tree, hearing nothing but the wind and the birds, or watching the light change on a cliff face until a petroglyph I hadn't seen before suddenly appeared. It's that kind of adventure 9 Mile can give you. It's not always about, the things that I've talked about, the crazy climbs, the adrenaline, and the danger. Sometimes it's just about being present. And for me, those were the stories within my visits that mattered most.
One more thing in possible meanings you point out in the book, some of these might have just been personal expression of a individual. It didn't
Absolutely.
have a grand meaning.
Yeah, not has a meaning, right? I mean, do you doodle? Everyone does it. You might be bored and sitting there making little spirals on a piece of paper. So yeah, there's not this grandiose ideation that every single one of them is incredibly significant. Most of them were a way to portray thought. But as far as what that thought was, it doesn't have to be a grandiose thing.
And it must be amazing to connect in a way. I mean, even if you don't know what the art means, thousands and thousands of years ago, there was somebody there who did this, and now you're interacting with it.
Yeah, I think that was the craziest thing for me. I've seen rock art. I've seen a ton of it. But just the sheer scale of this rock art, like, this is the highest concentration of rock art in North America. And it can be a little overwhelming. It really can, because there's just so much there. But that's kind of the beauty of it. Like, it's easier to admire the canyon for its beauty and the archaeological significance. But we can't forget that this is a sacred landscape, and it's one that deserves more than just a passing glance or a snapshot, right? So it's incredibly awe-inspiring to be standing on the ground looking at this panel that could be 1,000 years old and knowing that one of the indigenous, one of the ancient people were standing in that exact spot carving this into the art, into the rock. Like that was a very moving moment for me, just to have that roundabout connection of they were here, now I am here. And, with any hope, my granddaughter has told me she cannot wait until she has kids so she can take her kids here. She's 11 years old. So the fact that it has inspired her to look forward to bringing the next generation, that's more than I can ask for.
As part of this book, you talk to indigenous peoples, right? Descendants, in some cases, of the rock artists. I imagine there's an even more special connection to this rock art. What did they tell you?
Absolutely. So they shared old oral histories that have been passed down through generations. It does offer just a deeper, more human understanding of the canyon. The cool part about talking with Indigenous is their sense of storytelling is always present, right? And so when we would talk about a certain panel, in my book, I actually shared with permission some stories, storytelling about what that panel would mean for them and their culture. I'm going to give you an example. There is a wonderful petroglyph panel called Coyote Places the Stars. And it is very high up. You cannot hike to it. The landscape must have changed from when the indigenous were there placing it, or they were just phenomenal climbers. And I believe the latter to be true. But as far as us right now, I did not see a way to be able to get up to the panel. So I flew the drone up and snapped some pictures of it. And it is a picture of a coyote holding a bag. And the constellation, they believe, are all of the pecked dots that are laid out on the landscape. So they believe that it's coyote and he's placing the stars in the sky. So when I talked to the elders, the story for Coyote Places the Stars is coyote is known in indigenous history as being a trickster, and he's very impatient. So when the fire gods were placing the stars for the first people to be able to have light and be able to see, Coyote grew very impatient because the fire gods were lighting the stars on fire one at a time and placing them very, very carefully into the sky. Coyote grew impatient. He went and grabbed the blanket that the fire gods were holding the stars in, and he threw them up in the air. Which is why Indigenous believe that some stars are placed very strategically and we have our named constellations, while others are placed a little more haphazardly. So it was just really cool to hear their beliefs on why certain things happen in the past, who made them happen. Coyote's always in the stories as kind of a troublemaker. So it was just really cool to just sit and share those moments of oral histories that have been passed down generation to generation to generation.
You just joined us. We're talking with Verlise Perez. She has a new book. It's called Echoes of the Ancestors. It's a guidebook to 9 Mile Canyon, often called the world's longest art gallery. And we'll take another brief break. Be back with the final segment following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Verlise Perez. Her new book is called Echoes of the Ancestors. It's a guidebook to 9 Mile Canyon. So is the book out and available? Where do you get it? Let's see.
I'm
Yeah,
sorry, Tom,
there
can
you go.
you repeat that one?
I was just asking where to get the book, Amazon, other places?
Yeah, so I do. The book is actually on Amazon now. So you can order it through there, and you can also order it direct from my website. It is just nine, typed out the word 9milecanyonguide.com.
9milecanyon.com or Amazon.
9milecanyonguide.com. Yeah.
9milecanyonguide.com. Okay.
Correct.
I want to talk a little bit about the science. In your book, you talk about science behind rock art interpretation. You have a separate section on what you call your favorite thing, which is lichenometry. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are. Yeah, it just tickles me. It really, really does. And it's probably one of the nerdier sides of me. But lichenometry is how they measure how old lichen has been growing on a particular area. And lichen takes a long time to grow. So when I see a petroglyph that is covered in lichen, it just really sets the stage of how old that petroglyph truly is. I'll give you an example. In the book, I talk about a petroglyph that's about 3 inches. And lichen grows in Utah with the arid desert anywhere between, let's just call it like 0.5 millimeters, but it's every 5 to 10 years. So if you look at a 3-inch panel that's almost covered, that's 200 years just of the lichen growth, not to mention the rock art and how long that's been there. So it is a cool way that science do determine just some of the colonies of lichen that are growing on the petroglyph that can help them age a little bit more, as well as the patina. Patina takes thousands of years, and let me go into what patina is. It's the dark rock that you see in deserts. They call it desert varnish or patina. So patina takes thousands of years to grow. It's sediment and bacteria that grows on the rock and starts to adhere and starts to form this black, almost like a lacquer on top of the rock. So when you see a petroglyph that is starting to re-patina, meaning it's starting to re-blacken, it's incredible. It's incredible to think about how long patina takes to grow, and the fact that this thing is starting to get black again is just phenomenal to me.
Tell me a bit more about the science. And you have in your book, science in quotes. There's a lot of guesswork, frankly, right? How do archaeologists go about interpreting these panels?
Yeah, so there's different ways that they go about doing it, all the way from excavating a pit house and doing testing on the dirt. There's a site that I did not put in the book just due to the sensitivity of the area where they have found maize corn that has been left behind. And with DNA distractions, they aged that maize to be about 930 years old. But the thing that they're finding more and more with the petroglyphs and the pictographs is trying to get more indigenous cultures involved to get perspective versus assumption. And I think that's a really important thing. We cannot lose sight that there are still descendants of the people that lived there, and they do have oral histories that they can share. So I think that's one of the biggest things, or my takeaway from archaeologists is, yeah, they can do scientific testing like lichenometry. They can do DNA distraction on things that they find out there that are tangible. But as far as the petroglyphs, they are starting to lean more towards getting interpretations from indigenous cultures. And I think that's been a wonderful thing to have them included. Like for the pictographs, with the pigments that they use, they can also do DNA distractions to find out what this was or certain things like that. But rock art is a whole other different game. So it's been really cool to talk to the archaeologist and just have them express how grateful they are that more and more Indigenous elders are willing to come forward and share their information. So it's not so much assumption anymore. There's some actual oral history that's been passed down that's being dispersed.
Just a couple of minutes left. I want to maybe take on the practical advice. So if somebody's going to go to Nine Mile Canyon, of course, get your guidebook, right? Have that with you. It's somewhat near Price. How far out of Price?
It is actually about, I'd say, 20 minutes outside of Price. Right to the mouth to the canyon is in a town called Wellington. It's a quick day trip for me. I'm in northern Utah. More than worth the trip, regardless of where you're coming in. My book has been sold all the way to Maine, Georgia. I just sent one out to St. Paul, Minnesota. I met a man that came in specifically with to pick up my book from Colorado. So it's one of those places that if you're in Utah, and I don't care where in Utah, try to make it a place to visit. Super, super amazing place.
Yeah, amazing place. And look, don't touch, right?
Yes. Yeah. Can we touch on preservation real fast?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So preservation is one of the most urgent and complex issues we face, and it's something that weighs heavily on me every time I go out. This canyon holds thousands of years worth of cultural memory. And as resilient as these images and structures seem, they are incredibly fragile. One careless moment can erase what took generations to increase. So in my book, I'm very steadfast about kind of the more insidious, the unintentional damage. People touch the petroglyphs out of curiosity. And I understand that impulse, that it's very human to want to reach out and connect. But just the oils from our skin can alter the rock surface or degrade the patina and eventually erase these images. So I really want people to understand the why places like this matter, why they need protection. My book tries to do that. It's not just about how to find the sites, but how to see them differently, not as trophies or check marks on a hike, but as a living record of cultures that are still with us. So preservation isn't just the job of archaeologists or land managers. It's the responsibility of all of us who step foot in these places. I hope that you visit Nine Mile not just as a visitor, but as a steward, because if we do it right, we'll pass these stories on intact to the next generation so they can feel that same sense of awe and connection that we do when we see them.
Well, the book is called Echoes of the Ancestors. It's all about Nine Mile Canyon, and the author is Verlicia Perez. The website is ninemilecanyonguide.com, or you can get it on Amazon and other places. Verlicia Perez, a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Weiss. Do you know where your food comes from? Utahns once depended on local butchers for fresh meat. But in the early 1900s, business boomed for the Ogden Union Stockyards, signaling a shift in how and where Utahns purchased their food. Learn more after this.
I'm Jody Graham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities, with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. Today, most shoppers depend on large grocery chains to buy cuts of meat. But until the late 19th century, food was a more local affair. Most Utahns were close to their food sources, often growing their own gardens or visiting local farms. It wasn't uncommon to butcher your own meat or frequent a local butcher shop. But the relationship between food and community changed drastically in the early 20th century, as more Utahns moved away from farms into urban centers. Food became big business, and the Ogden Union Stockyards played a key role in this cultural shift in the Intermountain West. Beginning in the 1910s, as a few stock pens near the Ogden Rail Yard in Weber County, the Ogden Union Stockyards rapidly grew to be the largest stockyard operation west of Denver. Feeding city dwellers required several moving parts. The stockyards offered a streamlined operation designed to meet the changing needs of farmers and their businesses. Livestock could be purchased, slaughtered, packed up and shipped out on rail cars, all from the stockyards. It was truly a model of efficiency that helped move meat from rural Utah to more populous areas. As more people moved to cities, it became harder to feed a growing population who no longer raised their own livestock. Local farmers and butchers did not have the capacity to process large numbers of animals, and shipping meat was challenging. The Ogden Stockyard was a valuable stopover where animals could be rested and fattened up before arriving at their final destination, the slaughterhouse. Rail lines, refrigerated rail cars, and the industrialization of meat packing eased many of the barriers that previously prevented getting meat onto store shelves. The Ogden Union Stockyards not only helped move livestock and meat across the region, it also disconnected urban Utahns from the source of their food. Meat purchased from the shelves of grocery stores moved butchering outside of public view, separating consumers from their food source and the community that raised it. Although the Ogden Stockyards closed in the early 1970s, the relationship between those who raise food and those who consume it remains largely disconnected. Find sources and past episodes of the Beehive Archive at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of Utah Humanities, I'm Megan Weiss.